When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm John Hodge, joined by JC Abbott. JC, how are we going to manage without Dunk today? No one's going to bring up the University of Guelph.
Or Canadian quarterbacks. I don't think we have any in the rundown.
I
so
actually
that's going to be quite the challenge.
Do have a fun Canadian quarterback fact.
Hoisted by your own petard. That's what we're going to be on the Canadian quarterback front. John
Here's
Hodge
the thing, though,
losing all credibility this
Here's
week.
The thing, though. I don't think that Dunk knows this fun fact. So I am hopeful that he will listen to the show, learn it. Full disclosure, this fun fact will be dropped at the very end of the episode. So that's what they call a tease in the business. You got to listen to the whole thing in order to get the fun fact. Though then again, I guess fast forwarding exists. So if you want to just fast forward to the end of the show, feel free, but then come back to the beginning of the show and, of course, listen along.
Get the whole view if they fast forward? Like, does it still count as a
listen?
Because in that case,
think
just fast forward all the way through.
Well, I don't know if podcast credential, like I don't think the analytics really determine how much a play is. I think it's just downloads. So I don't think anybody knows how many people truly listen to podcasts. But also, they don't really know how many people listen to the radio or watch television. They're all just kind of guessing. Whatever. Yeah. I'm not an expert on these fields, but when I talk to radio people, I have routinely been shocked as to how little they actually know about how or who anybody is listening to. It's wow. Today, we're discussing Kenny Lawler and Robbie Smith cashing in CFL free agency.
A member of the Saskatchewan Roughriders suing Netflix.
Eugene Lewis firing back at Edmonton Elks general manager Ed Hervey.
Lucky Whitehead announcing his retirement.
And Demario Houston denying his domestic violence allegations. But first, on Monday, Three Down Nation published its first 2025 CFL power rankings, with the Saskatchewan Roughriders taking the top spot, followed by Montreal, Ottawa, Winnipeg, Edmonton, Toronto, Hamilton, BC, and Calgary at the bottom. What stood out most to you, JC, and did our voters get it right?
Well, the first thing that stood out to me, Hodge, was just how difficult this process was of ranking these teams at this stage of the offseason. There's a lot of clubs out there that have gotten better in some way, shape, or form, and given the parity that exists in the CFL on your average year, it's really hard to stack these teams up and get an accurate representation of where they are at. I think my big takeaway, and I was as guilty of this as anybody else, is when I look at the teams at the bottom of the rankings, it looks like we really aren't valuing elite quarterback play very much at all, right? When you look at teams like Calgary with Vernon Adams Jr., BC with Nathan Rourke, if he returns to form, Bo Levi Mitchell and what he did last year at Hamilton, and even Toronto there with Chad Kelly and what we all know he's capable of, they're all at the bottom of the rankings. And when you've got top three, top four type quarterbacks in this league, that should automatically catapult you up regardless of what the rest of your roster looks like. So I think there's a distinct possibility we could be undervaluing some of those teams because we're looking at the other moves and the other pieces and we're going, well, I don't know if this is enough here or that's enough there. An elite quarterback can solve a lot of problems if they stay healthy and they perform up to their potential. I think all of these teams have the ability to have a guy elevate them this season.
I agree that offseason power rankings are super hard. I did my rankings pretty quickly. And by the way that we do this is we've got 12 contributors across Three Down Nation. The two of us are two of those 12 who independently rank the nine teams, and then they are averaged out to create a 1 through 9 list. And as I'm looking at the grades here, I'm privy to all of the grades. Toronto has as low as 8 and as high as 1 when you look across the list. So there's a lot of differentiation here. The Alouettes are listed as high as 1 in some places, as low as 4 in other places. Calgary was as low as 9 on a lot of lists, but they were also as high as 5. Edmonton was as low as 8 and as high as 2. Saskatchewan was as high as 1, as low as 5. Winnipeg was as high as 3, as low as 7. And the point I'm trying to illustrate is in season, right, typically there's a lot of agreement across the board. You know, maybe, you know, this team gets a bunch of 9 place votes with a couple of 8s, maybe 1-7, or this team is 1 across the board, or this team is like a combination of 3s and 4s. The offseason is not like that at all. There's a lot of differentiation, which leads to kind of bizarre rankings. Like Toronto, for instance, ended up at 6, but nobody actually put them in 6th place. They got a couple of 1st place votes. They got 3 8th place votes, some 7s, a 4, a 5, and they end up in 6, even though nobody actually put them in the 6th spot. To me, I think that the Saskatchewan Roughriders do deserve to be number one. I had them number one on my list, and my reasoning for that is I think they solidified the middle of the offensive line. We'll talk about that a little bit more later in the show. I think defensively, they got even better. I do think that they had to upgrade that field side corner spot. That was a big problem for them, especially in the West Final. They've certainly done that with Tavon Campbell. And if Tavon Campbell ends up playing the boundary side, well, they can kick other guys over to field side. That's not going to be a problem. He also, I love that he provides extra ratio flexibility. So if they want to play three Americans on the offensive line, they can. I still have questions about AJ Ouellette, whether or not he is truly going to ever get back to what we saw him as with the Toronto Argonauts. But the depth, when you look at guys like Kalen Laybourne, when you look at guys who they've brought in Saskatchewan, or even Reichwell Armstead, who of course had a couple of fantastic outings for Saskatchewan after joining that team midseason, I think that they're going to be just fine in the backfield in Ryderville. I also think that it's rightful that the Calgary Stampeders came in last. They were the team I had at the bottom, and I don't want to discredit Vernon Adams Jr. because I do think they've gotten meaningfully better under center. That being said, I'm not convinced that going from Mark and Michelle to Dominic Rhymes is a massive, massive upgrade at wideout. And I also am not convinced that they've gotten a lot better in the secondary. I love the addition of Damon Webb, but they've also, in the meantime, not brought back Trey Roberson, who I thought started poorly last year, but finished strong. And I also, they've obviously lost Demiro Houston as well, which, again, we'll talk about later in the show. So I love the addition of Flowerin Remolade. I love the addition, of course, of some of their other pieces. But on the whole, Calgary was the 9th best team in the CFL last year, and they haven't done enough, at least for me, to get above. So I like the bookends at the top and bottom of this list. In the middle, I think there's a ton of argument to be made, and you could argue until you're blue in the face. I fought with my ballot for a while, but I do think that this is a good off-season ranking, even though it's not totally reflective of my ballot. I'm happy to live with it. I'm proud of this list.
Yeah, two other teams that I think are interesting in their positioning. The Montreal Alouettes at number 2. I think there's a lot of people who would argue, well, they were the top regular season team in the CFL last year, and they didn't lose very many pieces. Should they be the number one team because of that record and what they've been able to retain? I think there is that argument there. But again, it's a different quarterback. And as much as we like Davis Alexander, and we believe in that move to go younger at that position and bet on the potential, we really don't know what he's going to look like for a full season. And it feels a little bit awkward betting on a team to have that degree of success with a essentially a completely unproven quarterback. And then the other spot that I look at is the Winnipeg Blue Bombers at number four. And I know we're going to get into their roster specifically a little bit later in the show, but I think it bears just pointing out they've lost a lot of pieces. And I think there's a lot of reputational voguing happening here to put them in that number four spot because they've proven us to be wrong time and time again by getting back to the Grey Cup game every time that we've thought there was going to be a fall off of some sort. But from a pure talent perspective, if you're comparing the rosters apples to apples, a team like Edmonton, with all they've added through free agency, is miles ahead of where the Winnipeg Blue Bombers are on their roster right now. Does that necessarily translate to wins when that group hasn't gelled together? I'm not sure, but it's certainly an interesting question having the Bombers so high at this stage when we know the pieces they've lost.
The Montreal Alouettes were fourth on my ballot. I do think that having them at two is a little bit high for me. And my reasoning for that is I think people have largely forgotten that this team won two of its last eight games. And it is true that some of those games at the very end of the regular season were meaningless. But one of those games, they went to Vancouver and got absolutely pasted with mostly their starters playing by a score of 27-3. And then they lost at home to Winnipeg the last game of the season. Granted, they were the victims of a weather circumstance that still baffles the mind. And they did play a number of backups in that game. But still, they obviously lost the East Final to the Toronto Argonauts at home. They lost against Toronto at BMO Field in Toronto in Week 17. That was still a meaningful game. They also tied at Calgary. That was a meaningful game. They got beaten by 14 points by the BC Lions at home in Week 14. Like the Alouettes were a brilliant team for the first half to two-thirds of the season, and the wheels kind of came off. And it's not a huge shock. I don't think that they lost the East Final for that reason. And I don't want to look at the Montreal Alouettes as the team that started the year incredibly strong and was 9-1 essentially at the midway point of the season. I think you have to take the whole thing into account, and they weren't very good the last couple months of the season. And I think you make an astute point, JC, about Davis Alexander. As much as there were some people in that building who wanted Davis Alexander to be the starter late in the year and into the playoffs, he's only started a small handful of games. And when you look at some of the quarterbacks around this league, if Nathan Rourke gets back to his 2022 form, if you have guys like Zach Collaros potentially refining their form, Trevor Harris stays hot, VA is healthy, playing at an MOP level. If Chad Kelly gets back to full health, he starts playing back at an MOP level. Bo Levi Mitchell continues playing at an MOP level. Like, at some point, you got to look at the starting quarterbacks and go, okay, before Davis Alexander, I'm not saying he won't show us great things, but until he shows us some great things, is he not the ninth best starting quarterback in the CFL? I don't know. I think he has great potential, but he started five games. That is far fewer than anybody else in the CFL. Even Trey Ford, who's got over double that amount, I think close to 50, maybe even 20, starts under his belt. So to me, that is a question mark. The team that I had number two on my ballot was the Ottawa Redblacks. And my reasoning for that was this team, I think, has always been good up front defensively. I think the linebacking core has always been good. I think the secondary was a big issue for them last year. And I think coaching defensively, they got let down, especially in the playoffs. I think William Fields is a super strong addition to improve that defense from a coaching standpoint, from a scheme standpoint. He's a Grey Cup winning defensive coordinator for a reason. I also think Rick Campbell is going to boost those special teams at least a little bit. And offensively, this team was one of the best in the CFL last year, and they've now added a top receiver in Eugene Lewis to that group. Hopefully they'll have Khalil Pimpleton healthy for a full season. And then you put in William Standback. Like this offense, I think, is loaded. I think the defense is better personnel-wise in the secondary. I think off the field, they're better. I think Ottawa could arguably be the team to beat in the East Division right now. I think Hamilton's better, but I have some questions about their defensive line, if they're going to be able to get pressure with four. The Toronto Argonauts, who the heck even knows? Those guys are going to need those stickers on their helmets, you know, when training camp opens and they put the stickers on the helmets saying which name everybody is, because half of their team is new guys. I also don't want to write Toronto off. I think six is a little bit low for the defending Grey Cup champions, but let's not forget this team did win six fewer regular season games from 2023 to 2024. Didn't hurt them come the playoffs. They obviously went on a Grey Cup run, fair and square. Grey Cup champions, good for them. But I think it's really hard to look at that roster right now and go, oh yeah, this is just as good as they were a year ago. I don't. They've gone from having the best defensive line in the CFL to kind of having a group of castoffs from Saskatchewan who the Riders apparently didn't want anymore. Jeremy O'Day said it himself. We didn't lose anybody we offered. Well, they lost Brian Cox Jr., right? And they lost Anthony Lanier. Apparently the Riders did offer those guys, and that's why they're in Toronto on cheap deals that the team could afford. And they, after losing, you know, Jake Ceresna, Robbie Smith, all of these different playmakers who I think were the biggest factor in Toronto's Grey Cup victory.
Last thing I'll say on this particular topic before we move on, it's just a message to all the angry fans on social media who read this article and provided their commentary and criticism of our rankings. I'd just like to say, yes, you are correct. We do hate your team specifically and always have.
This past season, went on a trip, as everyone, I've said this on the podcast many times, my wife was born and raised in Toronto, like true Toronto. So we visit, I visited Toronto once or twice a year, every year for the past almost 15 years, with the exception, of course, of year one of the pandemic. And after the Argonauts game, I went specifically to overlap with an Argonauts game. They hosted the Calgary Stampeders, won that game. I did the post-game show with Ben Grant on his podcast, X's and Argos. And so many people reached out to him to be like, wow, I'm so glad that John Hodge has really turned a leaf and he doesn't seem to hate the Argonauts anymore. This is so amazing. And I'm like, I can't even begin to tell you how hating the Toronto Argonauts has never even once crossed my mind. I'm happy to go on Ben's show because Ben is a friend and he's a great contributor to Three Down Nation and he's an awesome guy and he does a great podcast. So of course I'm happy to go on. But Anyways. But I like how you said it, JC. Yeah, we hate all nine teams. That is it. But whichever team you cheer for, we hate the most. That is how we do things here. Absolutely.
Three Down Nation has reported that Kenny Lawler will be the CFL's highest paid non-quarterback in 2025, earning just over $275,000 from the Hamilton Tiger Cats and a maximum value of just over $300,000. The $275,000 is hard money. Robbie Smith, meanwhile, will be the league's highest paid defensive player in Edmonton, making $270,000 in hard money, plus another $6,000 in incentives. Would you call either of these contracts an overpay, Hodge?
Let's start with Kenny Lawler. Kenny Lawler is going to make slightly less money in hard money in 2025 than he did in 2024. And I also think that when you look at Kenny Lawler's most recent performances, right, especially the West Final, where he lit up one of the CFL's best defenses for three touchdowns, I think he'd be hard-pressed to call it an overpay. Yes, it is the highest-paid non-quarterback contract in the CFL, but Kenny Lawler is a unicorn, right? If you want someone who is that explosive, who has that type of catch radius, who has that proclivity for bringing down 50-50 balls, I don't think you can call it an overpay. I do think that Hamilton is allocating maybe a little bit too much money, a little bit too much percentage of their cap to the receiver position. When you look at guys like Tim White, what he's making, or Keandre Smith, who got a big raise, rightfully so, after almost having 1,000 yards last year. But I don't think the Kenny Lawler deal is an overpay. From what I was led to believe, the Bombers essentially gave Kenny a number, which was, I think, very close to what Eugene Lewis eventually got in Ottawa, right in that 220-230 range, and said, this is what we're willing to pay. If you can get more elsewhere, God bless you. And lo and behold, Kenny Lawler essentially got the same deal that he got from Winnipeg back in 2023 when he signed a two-year deal following a one-year stint in Edmonton. Only this time, he got it in Steeltown. And I also liked what Kenny Lawler said during his introductory press conference with the Tiger Cats. Obviously, the money was right, but he previously chased the money in Edmonton. That did not go well. He actually advised the entire CFL with a blanket statement saying, don't go to Edmonton, which was wild. I think that's the only time in my career I've ever heard somebody say a blanket statement like that about a particular CFL team. But he also said, I have a son who's on the autism spectrum. There are certain things off the field that we need in terms of community support, in terms of ensuring that he goes to a good school where he's going to be getting the care that he needs. And clearly the Hamilton Tiger Cats have done that. By the way, if people remember, the team that scored number one on the CFLPA report card was the Hamilton Tiger Cats. No, they did not do a ton of winning last year, missing the playoffs for the first time since 2017. But they have done a good job consistently of taking care of their players off the field. I wonder if that was a factor potentially in Kenny Lawler saying, hey, I'm used to things in Winnipeg where, yes, the players are taken care of well, but apparently players in Hamilton are taken care of even better. So why would I not want to go there and play for the Tiger Cats where I know that my family is going to be well received and well taken care of? I thought that was good. The Robbie Smith deal to me is interesting. Now, Robbie Smith, of course, is a Canadian. Canadian players with the ratio are always going to get a little bit of a bump in their salaries. That being said, this is a guy who has never before had more than six sacks in a season, right? That is interesting. He's also not like the most explosive athlete out there. 6'1", 245, not super long. Obviously, he's a two-time Grey Cup champion for a reason. He was a starter on probably the best defensive line in the CFL last year. And had he not blocked that field goal attempt in the 2022 Grey Cup, depending on who you talk to, the Argonauts might not have won that game. Some people feel that kick was going down the pipes. Some people feel that kick was going to miss by a million miles. Unfortunately, we'll never know for sure because that is how time works and fate works. And we can't go back and reverse it and get every single possible camera angle of that 2022 Grey Cup field goal attempt. That being said, as Milt Stegall says every year in free agency, you're worth what a team is willing to pay you. And the Edmonton Elks were happy to spend like drunken sailors at the defensive line position, not only bringing over Robbie Smith, but Jared Brinkman and Jake Cereza from Toronto as well. They've since brought in Brandon Barlow, which we're going to talk about a little bit later in the show. So good for Robbie Smith. I don't know if I'd call it an overpay. We know that Ed Hervey last year in Hamilton tried to make Brady Oliveira the highest paid running back, certainly in the CFL, and arguably the highest paid non-quarterback, because simply he wanted to get Canadian starters. He didn't feel he had enough Canadian talent on that roster. Robbie Smith is a Canadian starter. He's obviously a ratio breaker defensive end, a position that not a lot of Canadians start at. So I don't want to call it an overpay, but between these two deals, I would say that the Smith deal is more of an overpay than the Lawler deal is, if either of them is an overpay.
I'm going to start my commentary by saying I don't begrudge anybody for getting their bag, right? Football is a short-term sport. You don't have a lot of opportunities to receive the big contract. More power to these two gentlemen for getting theirs. But these are absolutely massive overpays because as much as I like these two players, you've got to understand the context of the market and what other guys are being paid as well. From a Kenny Lawler perspective, yes, he might well be the best receiver in the CFL and a one-of-one unicorn in terms of his ability to consistently get separation on the outside and be that deep threat and take the top off a defense. But at $300,000 of max value, well, what are the other guys getting paid right now? Because Justin McInnes, as a Canadian starter, who I thought was probably a little bit overpaid as well, we thought set the top of the market at $250,000. The top Americans besides Kenny Lawler are making $230,000-ish, $235,000-ish. That is a massive discrepancy between what Lawler's getting paid and what other guys at his position are making. And I don't think the gap between him and the other guys is that wide, at least in terms of your value and what you're bringing on a down-to-down basis. We've done this experiment before with him in Edmonton and what it means when he's making over $300,000. And as good as Lawler has always been on the field, he has, for a variety of reasons, both health-related and non-health-related, never played a full season. And one man cannot necessarily, particularly at the receiver position, elevate you over the top. Now, the Ticats have a great unit overall, but I think they are overpaying here to add one piece when they've got gaping holes elsewhere on the roster. As for Robbie Smith, I think he hit the nail on the head, right? Great player, ratio-breaking Canadian, but six sacks in back-to-back years? He's really solid. I'd want him as a starter on my team, but I'm not sure I would pay him to be the highest paid defensive player in the league. He doesn't have the same down-to-down destructive impact as other guys. I would argue he's the third best defensive lineman from Toronto that the Elks signed this year, right? Behind Jake Ceresna and Jared Brinkman. So to pay him this amount of money doesn't make a ton of sense to me at this stage. I don't think he is that far removed from some of the other guys that you could hypothetically start at Canadian defensive end. Is he that much different than an Isaac Adeyemi-Berglund or a Josh Archibald, who guys like potentially as a future starter? Is he better than Matthew Betts? I don't think so. And so at this stage, I do think that this is too much money to be paying for Robbie Smith.
We'll see what Matthew Betts does, obviously, back in the CFL in 2025. He did come back to the CFL midseason in 2024, but as is often the case with guys coming back from the NFL midseason, he wasn't very productive, right? His body was different. He was focused on other things. Going into, obviously, the NFL season, making the transition back to the CFL is not something that's easy to do in the middle of a year, especially when the team is already halfway through the schedule looking to make a push to the CFL playoffs. So I do think that Matthew Betts will get back to very good things in 2025. And you're right, JC. I do think that Matthew Betts is a better player than Robbie Smith. And when I think of the truly like elite disruptive defensive players in the CFL, I think of Jake Ceresna, I think of Whitten McManus, I think of Matthew Betts, I think of Willie Jefferson, I think of Roland Milligan Jr. I don't super think of Robbie Smith. Very good players. So again, that's why I tend to agree with you. This might be a bit of an overpay. But I also think that these two teams have something in common, and that is the fact that they were both non-playoff teams in 2024. And they are signing players away from teams who had really good things going. Like Kenny Lawler liked playing in Winnipeg, got to four Grey Cups with that team, winning two. And then Robbie Smith, who's from Brampton, which is right there if you're in Toronto, like he essentially is from the GTA, has won two Grey Cups with his hometown team, right? And played at Wilfrid Laurier, which is like obviously a little bit down the road west. But still, like this is a guy with a great home base who got paid good money in Toronto and was winning championships. Kenny Lawler was in Winnipeg, made really good money, was winning championships, or at least going to the Grey Cup every year, making that playoff money that every CFL player wants to make. So when you're trying to lure guys from good situations, you always have to pay more, especially when you're a non-playoff team. I think that's why these deals got to the level that they're at. Obviously, the goal for Ed Hervey and for Ted Gavaya, the general managers of these two respective teams, the goal is not to do this every year. The goal is to do this now, kickstart what I guess you could term a rebuild. I know Ted Gavaya is on the record saying he does not consider what he's doing in Hamilton to be a rebuild, but kickstart this reload, if you want to call it that, and say, okay, where can we get now in 2025? Because we need a little bit of an influx of talent, obviously, if we're looking to get to the playoffs again in 2025 after missing out last year.
And I will say that the nice thing about both of these players is, health allowing, if they're all on the field, I think it's unlikely that either of these guys is going to be a true bust, right? Sometimes we don't know how a player is necessarily going to fit in with a new team, but I think Lawler's going to be very productive with all the talent in the Ticats receiving core, and Robbie Smith is essentially going to do exactly what he did last year because the rest of the defensive line is just his teammates from the last 2 years, because they've also signed Brandon Barlow now, who played with him in 2023, to be the other defensive end. So it's all Argonauts up front for Edmonton, a very familiar situation for him. I don't think it's likely that either of these two guys flame out and make fans really question these contracts, but it's still an awful lot of money, and I think a little bit more than you wanted to spend on these two guys.
Would it be Edmondson Elkanat?
That's a good question. I think that's probably the best way to combine them. Typically, you want a 50-50 split, but you can't really do that.
Your old or broken phone can let you down. But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence with a new line on MyPlan and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. After all, you don't want your old phone to die on you when you're lost.
Perfect.
Or for your broken phone to glitch at the worst possible time.
Hey, can I get your number?
Oh. Trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And future stronger you can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And free fitness training to help you mix up your routine. Plus, most clubs are open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends February 28th. See home club for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
One is four letters and the other is not.
I'm thinking Elkanas.
The Elgos?
Elgos. That just makes me think of Egos, and now I'm getting hungry. So thank you very much, JC. Star receiver Eugene Lewis, who is now a member of the Ottawa Redblacks, recently fired back at Edmonton Elks GM Ed Hervey on 620 CKRM, saying he felt degraded that Hervey never reached out to speak with him prior to free agency getting underway. Lewis called himself a CFL superstar and said that Edmonton's decision not to talk to him before free agency was, quote, not smart, close quote. JC, are you on Hervey's side or Lewis's side?
I'm going to split the difference a little bit here because I do agree that Ed Hervey should have done Eugene Lewis, a veteran, the courtesy of picking up the phone or having somebody in his staff pick up the phone, call him, and let him into the loop of what they were planning to do privately so he wasn't necessarily feeling so disrespected. This is a relationship league. And even if there is no ill intent in your action, if somebody gets upset, somebody feels disrespected or degraded, as Eugene Lewis so clearly does, that has the potential to harm your team down the line. With that said, I don't necessarily think that Eugene Lewis was entitled to everything that he thinks he was entitled to. And in Hervey's defense, well, he did tell Lewis publicly what he was going to do, and then he backed that up by doing exactly what he said he was going to do. He said, I'm not paying him $300,000. I don't really know the guy. We've never talked, but I'll let him hit the open market so he can see what he's worth, and then if he wants to come back, he can, but I'm not paying him anywhere close to $300,000. That's exactly what Ed Hervey did. He just let him hit the market, and he wasn't going to pay any receiver anywhere close to that money. So in terms of Hervey being truthful, I mean, he was 100% a man of his word in this situation, whether Lewis likes it or not.
I think that Ed Hervey erred here a little bit. And that's not to say that he should have re-signed Eugene Lewis or paid him all the money in the world. The thing that I think he got wrong is what you laid out, JC, he needed to communicate better. And to prepare for this today, I went back and read Justin Dunk's article about Ed Hervey's amazing rant, where he reiterated about 17 times that he was not going to pay Eugene Lewis over $300,000. This is a quote from Ed Hervey. Am I best to insult a player who's used to making a certain amount of money by putting out what I have allocated for that position? Or am I best served to allow the market to dictate so he can get a sense of what his value is to the rest of the league? Then have the negotiation as far as talking dollars, because at least the numbers that I could be speaking with them about are relatively close to the rest of the market, if in fact the market is something that I want to participate in, close quote. He also readily admitted that he doesn't know Eugene Lewis. And essentially what Ed laid out is, rather than saying to Eugene, hey, I'm only willing to pay you $220, come back to me if you want your $220 to stay at Edmonton, what he said was, well, I'm not going to bother wasting his time. I'm just going to let him go and discover, oh, is there a market for me at $280, at $260, at $240, at $220, whatever, and then he can come back and talk to Ed about that later on. I think if you're Ed Hervey, the better thing to do is just say, hey, as you said, JC, now, I do think it can be a bit of a faux pas for GMs to reach out directly to players, right? Typically, they go through the agent. That being said, Eugene Lewis kind of sort of represents himself. It's a bit of an odd situation with him and his agent. I don't know if odd is the best word. Not per the norm, I think would be the best way to say it. He kind of represents himself. So regardless, I think Ed would have been smart here to just make that initial phone call and say, hey, we're going to let you go to the market and figure out, you know, in that window, what you could potentially get, what you might be worth. And if we can come to an agreement, we'd love to have you back at Edmonton because we think you're a great player. But we want to be, you know, upfront and honest and say we don't necessarily see receiver as a position where we want to allocate a ton of dollars. And if you do that and you compliment Eugene Lewis a little bit, we all know that players love to be complimented, especially receivers. I think that you save yourself some potential headaches. Right. The other thing that I thought was interesting is he admitted this and Eugene Lewis reiterated this when he did the radio interview saying, yeah, like, I don't know Ed Hervey. They've never met. I do think that that's odd. Like, one instance I can think of very clearly is back in 2011, or maybe it was 2012, but right near the start of his playing career, Adam Big Hill is running around on special teams for the BC Lions. And Mike O'Shea, I think it's the first year special teams coordinator of the Toronto Argonauts, sought him out after a game and was like, hey, you're really standing out on special teams. I think you're going to be a great player. And it was like a two-sentence exchange. And then years later, after Adam Big Hill is already a perennial all-star, you know, most outstanding defensive player, linebacker, and he's coming back from the NFL, where does he sign? He signs in Winnipeg. And part of the reason for that was he's like, yeah, Mike O'Shea, like 6 years ago, sought me out to say, hey, I think you're a great player and I see you and I want to validate what you're doing out there, which is not an uncommon thing for an opposing coach or personnel person to do. Now, I don't think Ed Hervey is the most affable or sociable person in the CFL when it comes to those types of things. But anyway, I do think that that is a type of conversation that would be very appropriate to have, even if the player is not on your team. It's certainly appropriate to have when the player is on your team. And I think that this could have been avoided to some extent. That being said, I mean, the $223 in hard money that Eugene Lewis is set to make, I think is appropriate value. It's obviously not nearly as much as Kenny Lawler got, but Eugene Lewis is a little bit older and is coming off, I mean, I don't want to say a down year because Kenny Lawler's numbers were down a little bit last year, but we all know that Edmonton's offense was quite run heavy in 2024. So that might have attributed to some of Eugene Lewis's drawback. I think the Red Blacks got a good deal, I'll put it that way, on Eugene Lewis. I think Eugene Lewis is a $225,000 receiver, and that's a good fit. But regardless, I think that both sides aired here a little bit. I do think that some like Eugene Lewis called himself a superstar and then compared himself to Ja'Marr Chase at one point. I thought that was a little bit hyperbolic. Go ahead.
Let's kick into that a little bit, because that's something I want to bring up, and I feel comfortable doing it because we don't have Dunk here this week, and I feel like this is a topic that would get Dunk a little bit fired up, to the contrary of me. But it really rubbed me the wrong way when Eugene Lewis made these superstar comments for a couple of reasons. A, I thought it was a little bit egotistical, but B, I just think it's a little inaccurate, and I hate when players do this and talk about being a superstar in the CFL and that dictating their contract and how they should be treated in certain ways. I just don't think this is a superstar league. And I think you could probably count on one hand, maybe less than one hand, the amount of guys that actually impact ticket sales around the league. To me, that's what a superstar means. Somebody that somebody is paying to come and see. And I just don't think there are that many situations in the CFL like that. I don't think Eugene Lewis is one of them. Frankly, I don't even think there's really that many superstars per se in pro football in general. I don't even think the NFL very much is a league like that. There are exceptions when it comes to certain quarterbacks and a few other guys. But for the most part, football is not a superstar sport in that way. People don't necessarily shell out their money to come see a specific player in the same way they might for hockey or especially basketball. It's just not a comparable in my mind. I wonder what you think about that, Hodge, and whether you think this superstar discourse sometimes gets blown out of proportion or loses touch with reality.
Well, Ja'Marr Chase had 1,700 yards and 17 touchdowns in 17 games last year. So the CFL equivalent to those numbers is 800 yards and 18 touchdowns. Last year, Eugene Lewis put up 1,070 yards and 10 touchdowns in 18 games. Is that a good season? Yes. Is that a Ja'Marr Chase season? No. Right? There's just no ifs, ands, or buts about that. And by the way, Eugene Lewis has never had more than 10 touchdown receptions in a season, and he's never had more than 1,300 yards. So I don't think that it's an appropriate comparison. And I do think it was a little egotistical of him to compare himself to Ja'Marr Chase. That being said, guess what? Receivers are egotistical. They're divas. They're prima donnas. This is what receivers do. There are exceptions. But as a rule, right, if you're looking for the biggest diva on the team, 9 times out of 10, you are going to the receiver corner and finding the biggest star receiver to talk to. And the only exception is when the team has a cornerback, right? Which is essentially the receiver of the defense. So I'm not surprised that Geno Lewis is walking around thinking of himself as the Ja'Marr Chase of the CFL. And if anything, good for Geno. Why? Because as a receiver, I do think that's a healthy mentality to have, saying, hey, I'm matching up one-on-one against this guy on this particular play. I know that I am the number one option in this route tree, and I am going to get that football, whether it kills me or I have to kill this guy to bring it down. And that mentality has obviously served Eugene Lewis well. He's been at all CFL selection 3 of the last 4 seasons. He's a very good receiver. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. But do I think he was a little bit egotistical? Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. And as for the ticket thing, JC, I will agree. I think the vast majority of fans buy tickets because of the logo on the helmet, not the name on the back of the jersey. There are exceptions to that. I think Trey Ford has meaningfully moved the needle in Edmonton. I think there are particular players who move the needle in other markets. Speaking to Winnipeg, for instance, I think the fact that Brady Oliveira and Nick Dembski being local is not lost on some fans. That being said, if Brady Oliveira was from Texas and Nick Dembski was from Oklahoma, I still think that Princess Auto Stadium would be very full because this team has gone to 5 straight Grey Cups and they've done a great job of making it a great party atmosphere. There's lots of people who go to Bomber games who don't particularly care about football. They go because it is a fun experience, not because they want to sit and watch a 3-hour game. So, I don't think that Eugene Lewis being at Edmonton means they're suddenly going to be selling the thing out. Commonwealth Stadium has been a cavernous wasteland for the last 2 years.
Hopefully, well, he's no longer in Edmonton.
Well, I'm just saying that he was there for the last 2 years and the stadium was empty. So if the logic is, well, I'm going to bring in tens of thousands of people, which to be very clear is not what Eugene Lewis said at all. But if that is the way in which somebody interpreted it, no, I think the results there speak for themselves. But either way, again, I think Ed Hervey could have managed this a little better. I think Eugene Lewis could have handled this a little bit better. And had they communicated more effectively, this doesn't become a big media story. That said, I'm happy it did because it's giving us something to talk about in January and February. And it's ultimately, therefore, good for the CFL because we need things to talk about during the offseason and keep fans engaged.
Hodge, you reported the earnings for all of Winnipeg's free agent additions and drew up a depth chart for how the Blue Bombers could look coming into training camp. Do you think this roster is better than it was 1 year ago?
I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritty of the depth chart. I encourage you to just look at it on 3donation.com to do that. To answer your question, JC, the answer is no. I don't think Winnipeg is better than it was a year ago. I think it's actually worse. That being said, after going through, I think there's been a lot of hand-wringing about the Bombers, like, oh my gosh, they've lost Liam Dobson, they've lost, you know, all of these guys, Kenny Lawler, they've lost, blah, blah, blah. I don't think that there's any reason to be pressing the panic button. And here's why. When you look at the receiving core, I mean, Dylan Mitchell at $150,000, that's a savings of almost $150,000 from what Kenny Lawler is making last year. I think there's optimism that he could be essentially a Kenny Lawler-like player. Dylan Mitchell's contract, by the way, has an incentive clause for reaching 2,000 receiving yards this season, worth $8,000. You got to love the optimism. It's only been done 3 times in CFL history. Imagine Dylan Mitchell goes for 2,000 yards in 2025. That would be wild. But when you look at Jarrett Stearns, when you look at Reggie White Jr., I think that the receiving core might lack the star power it had last year to some extent, but in a way, they've almost built Kenny Lawler out in aggregate, right? Like, is it better to have Kenny Lawler and rookies, or is it better to have Dylan Mitchell and some kind of crafty veteran receivers with upside, like Reggie White Jr., like Jarrett Stearns? Obviously, by the way, Dalton Schoen coming back after missing almost all of last season due to an ACL tear. I also, the other question I wanted to answer was, what is this team doing with marketing money? And this is aside from the random increase of $400,000 that happened kind of midway through free agency, which was a bit of a gong show in and of itself. Because I know a lot of people, whether they're Bomber fans or fans of other teams, have said, well, the Bombers are, you know, they break the salary cap every year. Like, oh, they're probably cheating with this marketing money. So I wanted to look at these contracts and say, hey, how much marketing money are these guys actually getting paid? Well, James Vaughters is their highest paid free agent addition at $160,000. Keep in mind, Dalton Schoen took about $50,000 less to come back. Kenny Lawler at $285,000 was not brought back. So this team did get noticeably cheaper. Yeah, they added more free agents, but none of them got paid more than $160,000 in hard money. Vaughters only has $5,000 of marketing money in his contract. Other players with marketing money: Jonathan Jones, the linebacker, did at $8,000. Stephen Logan, the returner, did to the tune of $7,500. But that's it. Like, Dylan Mitchell doesn't have any marketing. And when you look at some of the other deals that they did, like Eric Lofton at right tackle got a bit of a raise. He doesn't have any marketing money in his deal. Sergio Castillo got a raise after a good season last year. He didn't have any marketing money in his deal. Evan Holm got a big, big raise coming off of his rookie contract at fieldside halfback. He has $5,000 of marketing money. And that's not to say there aren't players with lots of marketing money in their deals. Brady Oliveira, for instance, has $50,000 of marketing money. That is one of the most in any contract in the CFL. But the point I'm trying to illustrate is Kyle Walters, first of all, denied that they were spending any of this extra money under the cap. They are operating as if the cap is remaining unchanged, which is kind of interesting. But also, these deals that they have signed, it's not like they're paying people $100,000 on the cap and $100,000 off the cap in an attempt to put together some type of Grey Cup run super team. One could argue that as likely the CFL's most profitable team, they should be doing that. I totally get that argument. But whether or not they should be doing that, the answer is they are not doing that. This team, I thought, negotiated, you know, pretty much market value contracts across the board with all the guys they brought in. Shea Patterson, $88,000 in hard money. Reggie White Jr. and Jarrett Stearns, the two kind of bargain receivers they added, are both between $85,000 and $90,000 in hard money. The depth Canadians they signed, Gavin Cobb, Brock Gowanlock, Josh Haggerty, and Enoch Bakonzo, they're all between $80,000 and $85,000 in hard money. Like, these are market rate contracts, and a lot of them have little to no marketing money in them, which I thought was the most interesting part of this deep dive. Winnipeg is hosting the Grey Cup this year, but you wouldn't know it based off of the way in which they are structuring these deals.
I I think the Bombers have done a decent enough job of keeping their heads above water in terms of the players they lost and having guys to replace them. I don't think they will be as good as they were last year. But then again, I didn't think they would be as good last year as they were the year before that. And they went back to the Grey Cup yet again, despite their terrible start to that season. So if you find the right combination of rookies to add to the mix and the team gels together, anything is possible. I don't think they have necessarily destroyed their chances going forward. As to your marketing money point, Hodge, I think this is an interesting thing to examine and perhaps something we should dive in a little bit more for all the teams in terms of comparing what their strategies are. Because when marketing money first came into effect, we had a lot of questions about it, right? This seemed to be this endless, uncapped pool of money that teams could just throw willy-nilly at whoever they damn well pleased without any sort of oversight. Well, we know that's not, at least in theory, true anymore, because during the Grey Cup, Randy Ambrosi said that marketing money would be audited to ensure that the players were, in fact, doing something that was worthwhile of receiving marketing money so that it wasn't being used to abuse the cap. Now, we don't know the results of that audit yet. The CFL has not released which teams were over the cap last year or any punishments for anybody who may have overspent in marketing money or promised more than their players were able to deliver. But we do know in theory you can be punished for guys not backing up their marketing obligations with actual performance out in the community, so to speak, and then that money would be rolled onto the salary cap in that circumstance. So to be selective with who you're giving that marketing money to might actually be an intelligent move. Yes, $50,000 for Brady Oliveira for marketing money sounds insane, but he's a Winnipeg guy who is in his hometown, I'm sure does lots of appearances as a result of that, just naturally has more connections and does a ton of volunteer work and posts on social media about the stuff he does rescuing dogs, which I think you could argue also counts as marketing for the league. So that's a guy that you can very well point to and say, okay, he's delivering on that marketing money promise. I think some of the other teams that have paid marketing money to certain guys, you wonder, well, how much marketing is he really doing for that team or for the league based on that amount of money? The Bombers, by being a little bit more selective, can perhaps avoid that problem as the league figures out how they're going to legislate all this.
The other thing with the marketing money, like let's use Brady Oliveira as an example. Brady Oliveira has more Instagram followers than the CFL. Hmm. I'm going to say that again, because that is a correct factual statement. Brady Oliveira has more followers on Instagram than the CFL. It's close, but he does. So when he posts something about the CFL on his personal Instagram account, one could argue, right, an account of his size, I don't know what the numbers are. I'm certainly not a social media influencer, but one could argue that one of his posts is worth $25,000. So if he is making $50,000 in marketing money, one could argue that two CFL / Winnipeg Blue Bombers related posts is enough to earn him his money. The other thing that I've heard with some of this marketing money is, well, some guys do not have this marketing money guaranteed in their contract. So if, let's say, they have $20,000 in there and none of it ends up getting paid out because the guy didn't do the appearances that he was supposed to or whatever else, the team simply doesn't pay it out and it's a non-issue. Some players, however, as part of their contracts, have additional paperwork guaranteeing that money, which means that if they don't do the marketing appearances, that money simply gets turned into salary that then counts against the salary cap. So this is a convoluted, bizarre, strange issue that appears to differ from player to player. And though we are able to source a lot of that information, obviously it's not like the CFL is putting out reports all the time about these detailed contracts and which players have the money guaranteed, which ones don't, who's doing their appearances, who's not, whatever. So it's a convoluted issue. At the end of the day, the question I most wanted to answer was, how much are these guys getting paid? How is it structured and how do they fit into the roster? And I think I succeeded in all three facets of that. So I'm happy with how the article turned out. I have also, and by the way, touching on one last issue, the one area where I do think the Bombers will suffer in 2025, because I'm not convinced on the whole that they are not as good of a roster. I certainly don't think they're better, but on the whole, I'm not convinced their roster is not as good as last year. I think it's a little bit of a downgrade, but not much of one. The one area I do think they are meaningfully going to struggle with in 2025 relative to 2024 is with their ratio flexibility. Like, this team last year generally started 8 Canadians. That's one more than the minimum of 7. They also started as many as 10 in some games. And it's easy to do that when you've got a Canadian running back, a position where almost no Canadians play, and he's the best one in the CFL, right, in Brady Oliveira. They also have a corner starting last year in Tyrell Ford, who's not just a Canadian token starter. He is arguably the best cornerback in the CFL, right? They also have Rheta Cramdy starting at strong side linebacker, a position where Canadians almost never play. And according to PFF, he was the second best strong side linebacker in the CFL in 2024. Like, these are not just token Canadian starters playing some untraditional positions. These are high-level impact starters breaking the ratio, while they're also starting 3 Canadians along the offensive line. They're also starting 2 receivers. They're also starting a nose tackle, right? They're doing a lot of the traditional positions on top of these non-traditional ones. Well, obviously, following the departure of Tyrell Ford, they no longer have a high-level Canadian corner who's going to be starting there. This team also might not be able to start 3 Canadian offensive linemen following the departure of Liam Dobson. So when you look at the depth chart I've made for them now, there's 7 Canadian starters. I think all 7 are good starters, but it's not like they've got an easy 8 or 9 to throw out anymore. They do have what will likely end up being 4 draft picks in the top 26 for a good 2025 class. That will help flesh things out a little bit. But I do think that the team's Canadian talent is not going to be as strong as it was a year ago. And that was kind of, I think it was bound to happen, because it's simply impossible to keep that many high-level Canadians because they just get paid too much money, right? You're not going to be able to keep that type of roster together forever. But I, at the end of the day, do think it's a good roster still. The ratio flexibility is where they took the biggest hit. Saskatchewan Roughriders linebacker CJ Rivas is one of 6 players suing Netflix for $30 million over their series Last Chance U, claiming they were depicted in, quote, misleading, offensive, or highly objectionable, close quote, ways on the program, which affected their future prospects in professional football. 3 of the other plaintiffs have also had CFL stints, including defensive lineman Tim Bonner and Ronald Ollie, and quarterback-turned-receiver John Franklin III. What do you make of the lawsuit?
This is going to be a fascinating legal situation to watch play out because of a number of different reasons, and also because of the profile of this show. I don't know if you've watched Last Chance U, Hodge. I certainly did when it first came out, and I always found myself coming away a little bit uncomfortable with the whole thing. Both the way the players and the situations were portrayed, some of the coaching I didn't think was entirely appropriate either, but it was definitely exploitative in nature, finding entertainment in the situations of these young men who, in some cases, had come from some really difficult circumstances. Now, there is another element to this lawsuit in terms of what they are claiming. Yes, they're claiming that they were depicted poorly, particularly in the case of a guy like Ronald Ollie, who was one of the faces of that initial first season and was sort of portrayed as lazy and not entirely motivated. He claims that that hurt him going forward. I can certainly see how that could have been the case. But the other thing is that they weren't compensated in any way for the success of this show. They, in essence, were the product. They were packaged up, but they didn't receive anything in return. And based on how successful that program was, and the era we're in now from a legal standpoint in amateur athletics with NIL and players finally being compensated for their name, image, and likeness, I wonder if judges are going to be a little bit more willing to consider the fact that the contracts these guys might have signed that didn't compensate them for essentially their name, image, and likeness was exploitative, and that they are due back pay for how successful this program was. It'll be interesting to see it play out, and it could have some wide-reaching impacts in terms of other guys who are on the show who have gone on to success in football or in life, or have struggled in football or life after the show, and other documentaries where we see people in these difficult situations get highlighted and not necessarily receive anything in return for us finding entertainment from their plight.
It'll be very interesting, and I'm sure that this lawsuit is going to be followed very closely by dozens of other reality shows that are of this style, right? Where they are essentially asking people, hey, for free, will you be famous and allow cameras in your home, where we then have the creative power to depict or edit this in any way that we want. I don't have an opinion on Last Chance U. I've never watched Last Chance U. I know it exists. I'm aware that it exists. I've never watched it. The first season took place at East Mississippi Community College. And correct me if I'm wrong, JC, but essentially the premise is these are guys who have either academic problems or personal problems that have prevented them from garnering scholarships at major college programs. And this is their last opportunity to get that. Is that accurate?
Somewhat accurate. Either they weren't able to get it initially, like a Ronald Ollie would have fallen in that situation, or they're a guy who did get that interest and has then either been flunked out of their Division I program or has been booted out of that program for conflicts with coaches or violating team rules, as was the case with a number of other guys. I believe CJ Rivas was booted from his initial college program for an undisclosed team rules violation, and that's sort of the situation that he found himself in. You go to JUCO to try and regain your reputation and find a new landing spot at the Division I level.
And by JUCO, you mean the junior college level, for those who might not know what JUCO means. The first two seasons of the show, it debuted in 2016, were set at East Mississippi Community College. Seasons 3 and 4 were set at Independence Community College. And season 5 was at Laney College. The show wrapped in 2020 after producing 38 episodes. So very interesting to see what happens with this. We'll have to wait and see if Netflix's lawyers, who wrote what I'm sure were very thorough initial waiver forms, got the money that they deserve, because if they didn't write those waivers well enough and they are now potentially going to be thrown out in court, yeah, Netflix could be paying out a lot of money to not just these people, but a lot of television networks could be paying out a lot of money to people in similar programming. It's now time for Hodge's Heritage Moment. On this day in 2010, Last Chance U alum Mike O'Shea, no, I'm just kidding. He never appeared on Last Chance U. Mike O'Shea was
the worst reality TV program of all time would follow Mike O'Shea.
It's just him fishing in North Bay again. Like, that's just the show. It's like, well, like, yesterday he fished and today he's fishing again.
They would do an interview and he'd say, I don't understand why that's any of your business. And then he would respond.
Correct.
And
correct.
Sit in silence for an hour.
And by the way, I don't even know if Mike O'Shea fishes. That's just speculation based on context cues. If I asked him if he fished, I don't think he would tell me. I know Mike O'Shea coaches football and watches hockey. That's as far as I've gotten in all my years of covering the team.
I know he likes planes. He likes old planes.
He likes, well, his father, I believe, either his father, this is public information, his father or grandfather fought in the Second World War. So he is passionate about military history. So that is something that we do know. I also have met his son, Michael O'Shea Jr., who played the last two seasons at the University of Manitoba. So, like, I've gotten to know his family, but, like, Mike O'Shea is just a big mystery still. Yeah.
My favorite Mike O'Shea moment, if we could do a quick aside, is just, I forget whether it was touchdown. No, it was, he was arriving for the Grey Cup 2 years ago, and they got to the hangar in, was it Hamilton? Or no, it was in Regina, wherever it was. And the team playing there, we all go to interview these guys. And while the interviews are happening, Mike O'Shea is just wandering around in the back in his khaki shorts, looking at the planes in just complete dad mode. It was the most quintessential like middle-aged father thing I've ever seen a person do. Like, you could have put my dad doing the exact same thing and it will look exactly the same, except this man was about to do a press conference because he had a Grey Cup game to coach in a week.
Yeah, I'd like to think that at some point he smacked some of the welding that was holding some of the sheet metal to get metal together and uttered the phrase, "That's not going anywhere." Like, that's
probably did.
That's a peak dad phrase. "Oh, that's not going anywhere." You know, like I would like to think that, that happened at some point, but I don't know. I can't speak to that. Anyways, getting back to the original thought, this is the longest Hodges heritage moment we've ever had, and I haven't actually read the thing yet. In 2010, Mike O'Shea was hired by the Toronto Argonauts as the team's special teams coordinator. The native of North Bay, Ontario, had recently finished his 16-year playing career at linebacker with Hamilton in Toronto. The three-time East Division All-Star won three Grey Cups and retired as the only Canadian player in CFL history with more than 1,000 tackles, recording 1,154. O'Shea was inducted into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame as a player in 2017. He has since won three more Grey Cups as the special teams coordinator in Toronto and the head coach of the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, and now sits tied for eighth in head coaching wins at 107. My question for you, JC, if Mike O'Shea is already in as a player, can he also go in as a coach? Is that a thing?
I don't believe so. I think you're one and done when it comes to the Hall of Fame, but it is absolutely ridiculous that this man has had two Hall of Fame careers, because you could argue if he was split in two at the moment he retired and the new Mike O'Shea who entered coaching was a different person, he has an indisputable Hall of Fame resume on that side as well after already being a Hall of Fame player. That is remarkable. Even guys like Wally Buono and Hugh Campbell, who were very good players in the CFL before they started coaching, can't make that claim. They were not necessarily Hall of Fame players. They were very good players, but they were Hall of Fame coaches. Mike O'Shea was both.
He is, and by the way, he is currently tied for eighth. He's only one win behind Dave Ritchie for seventh. So assuming that the Bombers go at least 2-16 in 2025, he will be seventh come, you know, the mid or after at least the 2025 season. And he can't catch anybody else within the next year. But presumably, if he continues coaching beyond 2025, he will be in a position to pass more people. And everybody ahead of him on that coaching list and many coaches behind him are already in the Hall of Fame. The only one who wasn't ahead of him or the only one ahead of him who wasn't in the Hall of Fame was Ray Yock, and he got in just last year. So the precedent is, yes, you're right, JC. He should be in as a coach in addition to being a player, which is pretty wild. Let's go to the three-minute drill. Cody Fajardo took an over $200,000 pay cut to restructure his deal with the Edmonton Elks, Three Down Nation reported. Is that a good deal for the Elks?
I think it is. They're essentially paying two quarterbacks for just around $500,000. That's what most teams are playing for one elite quarterback. I think that works out really well for this organization. Whether Trey Ford has a ton of success or whether he stumbles, they'll be in a good spot. Demario Houston has denied the domestic violence allegations against him. Do you ever think we'll see him back in the CFL?
I think it's possible, but I think the legal process has to come to a conclusion. As you reported, JC, his next hearing isn't until March. So depending on how things go, like if the charges end up getting dropped, I think it's very much possible. If he gets convicted of something, then I'm more skeptical. Lucky Whitehead has retired from professional football. How will you remember the gregarious receiver and return specialist?
Well, there were some great on-the-field moments, but I'm going to remember him for his time with the BC Lions, his stadium entrances. For those of you who were not familiar, go look them up on YouTube or Google them and scroll back through the BC Lions Twitter page. Every single game at BC Place, he would come into the stadium in an interesting manner. Either he'd be, you know, riding a unicycle, or he would ride a horse across the field on one occasion. He had a cart full of watermelons one day against the Riders. Every week was unique. They got escalated in their performativeness, and it was the highlight of every game, sitting in the press box with my colleague J.J. Adams before the Lions were set to kick off, and we'd be scrolling for, waiting for the Lions to post the video on Twitter just to see what Lucky Whitehead had done that week, this week. That's why he was such a fan favorite, and I wish him the best in retirement. Three Down Nation contributor Brendan McGuire wrote that the Saskatchewan Roughriders should rethink their Canadian offensive line strategy. Does that make sense?
Well, essentially the premise of BMAC's article was this team has been trying desperately to start three Canadian offensive linemen, and with some retirements that have happened, some injuries that have happened, it just hasn't worked out. Now, with Sean McEwen manning the middle, a move that came right after our last episode was recorded, I think that their starting three are good, right? Philippe Gagnon is there, but I also think with some of the talent that Saskatchewan has at receiver, at defensive back, they can start three Americans on the offensive line, and that might not be a bad strategy moving forward. The Ottawa Redblacks re-signed Nigel Romek, who is the last remaining original member of the team. Is that a good move?
I don't think it's a bad move, necessarily, especially if they're paying him near the minimum. But at this stage, at 33 years old, he only had 6 special teams tackles last year. I think this is more of a legacy signing than anything else. I'm not sure it's a move that I personally would have made. Former first-round CFL draft pick Enoch Mokonzo has signed with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers after missing all of last season with a torn Achilles. Is that a good move?
I don't know what the Winnipeg Blue Bombers is, but yes, Enoch Mokonzo, I think, is a good signing. He was a dominant safety at Coastal Carolina. Hasn't super translated to success in the CFL, but he got injured last year, missed all of last season. So this is, to me, a good depth signing for Winnipeg. They don't really have anybody else who can play Sam behind Reddick Cramdy. This is a good move. The Edmonton Elks have signed Brandon Barlow following his release from Hamilton. Can he refine his form from 2023?
Well, in 2023, he was playing on a tremendous Toronto Argonauts defensive line. And now in Edmonton, he's playing on a tremendous Toronto Argonauts defensive line, essentially. I think you could argue this is the best defensive line in the CFL, and that's going to make his job a lot easier. I think he'll be very productive this season. Former first-round CFL draft pick Anthony Bennett has signed with the Montreal Alouettes. Is that a good signing?
I think so. I know that you're not super high on Bennett, JC, but he was a first-team All-Canadian with the Regina Rams in 2022. Didn't have a great rookie season with Winnipeg in 2023, but the reason he didn't play last year was due to injury. I believe it was a back issue. And I don't think this has been reported anywhere, but Bennett was often around the Bombers last year. Like, you'd go to games, you go in the locker room post-game to do your interviews, and Anthony Bennett would be there hanging out with the defensive lineman. So he's been around football for the past year. I'm glad that he's getting a second shot with the Alouettes. David Mackey has been hired as the new executive director of the CFLPA, Three Down Nation is reported, following his retirement from the BC Lions. Is that a good move?
I think it's always a good move to have a highly intelligent, experienced player in that role with the PA. David Mackey certainly fits that bill, has done a lot of work with the PA over the last number of years. It's a terrible move for the BC Lions, though, because David Mackey, I think you could argue, was the most underrated player in the CFL. He did so much for that team, both from a blocking capacity, a short yardage capacity, receiving out of the backfield, special teams. He was truly an elite stud at the fullback position. He will be greatly missed, but I'm glad I'll get to see him at CFL events going forward. Longtime Montreal Alouettes player and legendary McGill head coach Charlie Bailey passed away on Monday at the age of 90. How will you remember him?
Well, first of all, I didn't know who Charlie Bailey was, admittedly. So I was happy to read all of his accomplishments. 29 years at McGill University, led that team to 3 Vanier Cup appearances, winning one, still the only Vanier Cup victory in McGill football history. But the other thing that was interesting is his father, Donald Bailey, is credited, and this is from a press release from McGill University, as the first Canadian university quarterback ever to attempt a forward pass in a game. It happened in 1921. That is an amazing piece of CFL or Canadian football history of lore. And I had no idea that that was the case. So assuming that this is in fact accurate, I think that Justin Dunk needs to create a Donald Bailey shrine in his closet somewhere. The first Canadian University quarterback ever to throw a pass in a game. This is the person who started it all. The late Charlie Bailey's father. So, amazing football family. And by the way, Ray, Charlie's twin brother, who passed away at age 80 in 2015, was also like a 10-year CFL player who then coached at McGill alongside his twin brother for 7 years. So the Bailey family, tremendous, tremendous contributions to Canadian football history. Credit to that family, and our condolences, of course, to Charlie's family and friends. Age 90, what a life he lived. Mm-hmm. On that note, we thank you as always for listening to the Three Down Nation podcast. For JC Abbott, I'm John Hodge. We'll see you again next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI and a watch and tab on any plan. Only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan. Service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.